racist there, and so he's moving his ass, and he's doing what he's supposed to do, and it's really maintaining what he said he was going to do. And throughout his whole campaign, he was maintaining his speech, you know, he was maintaining everything that he said. And, yeah, I was pretty impressed.
Yeah, Luisa, what do you think of Mr. Obama?
I think he's a great guy. I think he's going to do some good for not just their country, but who might be inspired by someone other than a white man.
someone other than George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Well, that's we're pretty much out of time now, but Luisa, Melissa, thank you very much for being on the show again.
No problem.
And just to let you know that we're here once every month, the last Tuesday of every month, and we'll be back next Tuesday. And just to let you know that Soul Perspectives is coming up next, and stay tuned for Native Solidarity News, which is coming up next week, same time, same channel. McGuish.
I've got money, and now I need love. I've got money, and now I need love.
CITR's third annual fund drive is on now. You can make your mark on our station by calling 604-822-8648. That's 604-UBC-UNIT. Remember that right now to make a donation. Can't make it to the phone? Visit www.citr.ca/donate and make a donation online. You'll be directed to the campus development office, and you can donate safely on there. Further details can be found on our website at www.citr.ca. So get your donation in fast to collect great prizes. The fund drive ends November 27th, so do it now.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello, I'm Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. Early this spring, Canadian writer Terrence Gresco released his latest book titled Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. This is what he writes. In the first decade of the 21st century, it is becoming clear that the world's oceans are being transformed, and not for the better. A paper in the esteemed journal Nature reports that 90% of the population of top-level predators, among them tuna, sharks, marlin, and swordfish, have already been caught. A team of ecologists makes headlines worldwide by predicting that at the current rate of exploitation, all major fish stocks will collapse within our lifetimes. The world, in other words, will run out of wild seafood by the year 2048. Terrence Gresco concludes, "Our future, as one fisheries expert has memorably put it," and that expert, by the way, is my guest today, Dr. Polly from UBC, "our future may be a diet of peanut butter and jellyfish sandwiches." This is Prof Talk. On today's show, I speak with Dr. Daniel Polly, renowned marine scientist from UBC, who is one of the world's leading experts on the human impacts on global fisheries. Today's show is part of a two-part series on the current crisis of the world's marine ecosystems. Next Tuesday, I will speak with Mr. Todd Jones from the UBC Department of Zoology, a PhD candidate whose research of an endangered species of turtle is groundbreaking, proving that today our oceans are losing species that have roamed our planet since time immemorial. In our lifetimes, we have witnessed the collapse of the cod fisheries in eastern Canada, and closer to home, the dwindling numbers of the return of salmon in the thousands of rivers and streams along the west coast of BC. In my teenage years, I spent 2 weeks in a small fishing village on the western coast of Newfoundland and saw firsthand how fishermen who had fished Atlantic cod for more than 7 generations had lost their livelihoods overnight and who desperately began to fish for lobster. As an avid fisherwoman myself, every year along the Vedder, Fraser, and Squamish rivers, there are fewer salmon to catch, and even in some of my most memorable fishing trips in the northern coastal waters of Bella Coola, where 5 species of Pacific salmon return to spawn, every year there are fewer to fish. Have a listen now to Dr. David Suzuki speak at a conference that took place last April 2007, titled Fish Forever, Seafood Choices for a Sustainable Planet.
I was born in Vancouver in 1936. When I was a boy, Dad would take me in a rowboat and we would row around Siwash Rock in Stanley Park and troll for sea-run cutthroats. We jigged for halibut off Spanish Banks. We caught sturgeon any time in the Fraser River, and my greatest memories were of camping along the Vedder River, where we would fish for Dolly Varden and steelhead. There were still rivers and streams and creeks in Vancouver when I was a boy, with their own distinctive races of salmon and cutthroat trout. After the war, we left British Columbia, reluctantly, ended up in London, Ontario. And in the 1950s, I remember in a geography class, my teacher told us, the oceans are filled with limitless sources of protein, fish. The problems of the oceans back then was trying to convince people to eat fish. They didn't like fish, especially if you lived in the center of Canada. All my life, fish have played a huge role in my activities. My fascination with fish led me to a career in biology. Our oceans are now threatened by the deadliest predator ever to appear on the planet, and that is us.
Today I interview Dr. Daniel Polly, a preeminent scientist committed to marine protection who has just left his position as the director of the UBC's Fisheries Centre, which he held since November 2003. According to the journal Scientific American, he is considered to be one of the 50 most influential scientists, most prolific and cited in the world in his research field, and key, often controversial, in modern fishing practices. Professor Daniel Polly is a world authority in the study of the decline of fish stocks and the ecosystem's response to human pressure. He has developed and used new techniques which have made it possible to analyze the global impact of fishing on marine ecosystems. He has assessed this impact by means of a widely accepted marine trophic index and has converted the EcoPath model into one of the most frequently used ecosystem modeling tools. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration of the United States has considered this model to be one of the most outstanding achievements of the last 200 years. I reached Dr. Polly in his office. First, I want to congratulate you on receiving the Ramon Margalef Prize in Ecology and Environmental Science in Barcelona last month.
Thank you very much.
Now, you have dedicated your life to studying the impact of fisheries on the world's marine ecosystems. Can you give us a snapshot of what you have witnessed, say, in the last 30 years of the decline of fish stocks around the world?
Let's make a difference between what I have witnessed and what I've documented, because we can document things that are going further than our own lives, right? And in my own life, I have seen some major fisheries go down, the major one being the cod, the northern cod in Canada. But I have also seen individual fisheries that I knew of also being destroyed. And I have traveled a lot in the world, and I have seen that in Asia, in Africa, in Oceania, and everywhere that I have been in the Americas. And that is the pattern being the same everywhere that gives me the confidence that this is really the major pattern affecting fisheries. And then I realized that there is no reason for me as observer to be privileged in that this stuff that I'm seeing is affecting only me in my lifetime. And I realized the process known as shifting baseline, that we privilege our own life and assess what happens in our life, but lifetime. But earlier generation have seen similar things happen in their lifetimes, and if we don't use their knowledge and the point where they started, we lose the understanding that abundances were much bigger before.
Now, Dr. Polly, you have been quoted as saying that soon our seas will be full of jellyfish, happily feeding on zooplankton. Can you explain this? What do you mean by that?
If you fish in the ocean, you generally remove large fish. And large fish are, a number of them, prey on jellyfish. Also, you modify the bottom habitat, and you remove lots of bottom organisms. You kill them, and these bottom organisms are the competitors of the sessile, the polyp stage of jellyfish. So the the jellyfish have no problem with the polyp stage. They form when they are attached to the bottom, and they have no problem with the adult phase. That is the proliferate. They were before constrained by competition and predation, and they are not anymore, and they proliferate, and they themselves become the top predator in the system because they consume fish eggs and fish larvae, so they prevent the fish, which before had controlled them, from ever coming up again. And there are a number of systems where jellyfish are now dominant.
Now, overfishing is largely attributed to the practice of bottom trawling, but it is also responsible for destroying the entire sort of seabed system. Yeah. Can you explain how bottom trawlers work and why they are so dangerous to our oceans?
Bottom trawling, in addition to fishing, also modify habitat. You don't do that when you have long lines and you exploit tuna. You can also, and you do, overfish. We overfish the open ocean ecosystem with long lines, but they don't modify the bottom, the sea bottom, because we don't touch it. Trawlers, in addition, modify the habitat. And they modified big time. And in the past, an analogy was made to plowing. But plowing is makes nutrient available which to plants, because the plants extract nutrients from the bottom. In the ocean, there are no plants living at the bottom at depth. There are only animals anchoring themselves at the bottom. So they don't benefit from plowing. In fact, plowing kills them. And that's plowing is what trawlers do. Plowing everything in their path, and destroying all the animals that live on the bottom that essentially maintain the sea bottom livable for lots of animals, which then becomes a big mud bed, mud flat, which then is not hospitable for lots of animals.
Now, this is just one aspect of our sort of oceans, the fisheries crisis.
Right, just one tiny aspect of...
What else could you add to that?
Well, we also modify the mangrove, coral reefs, and other estuarine near-shore habitat by pollution and by construction. And this destroyed crucial habitat because a number of shellfish or fish that lives on a near shore area utilize this habitat that I mentioned, mangroves and so on, and as nurseries. And when the nurseries are gone, the stocks also go down. This is a further cause of habitat loss and hence of reduction of fish population.
Now, how does global warming add to that, to the fisheries
to
crisis?
It's beginning to be a major effect. It is still not as strong as fishing itself is, but it will be. Essentially, it moves fish around. On the northern hemisphere, it moves them toward the North Pole. In the southern hemisphere, toward the South Pole. And to a certain extent, it doesn't... The fish, it doesn't matter to them whether they live 200 kilometers further north or further south. It doesn't matter. But it actually does, because they have evolved to utilize in their migration certain fixed positions, certain fixed grounds. And if they have to move because the temperature of the ocean forces them to do that, they lose this point of orientation. And they generally don't do so well in the new habitat. Some do, and they are invasive species, but mostly they don't. So you have a decline of the productivity of the ocean for humans.
Now, Dr. Polly, so many of us are opting for a diet rich in omega-3, an essential fatty acid found in seafood, but we're constantly bombarded
In nuts and in various other vegetables.
That's right. But the eating seafood, we're constantly bombarded with news stories about, consumption of tuna, the mercury that exists in tuna, the farm salmon containing sea lice. What advice do you have to those of us who want to eat seafood with a clear conscience?
I would advise you, especially if I were a woman of childbearing age, the benefit of the amino acid, the omega-3, are far outweighed by the risk associated with eating nasty stuff that would concentrate in the baby. Far outweighed. For a young woman to eat lots of fish to protect her heart is crazy if she, at the same time, she eats lots of stuff which is going to harm her and the baby. That, for old people, the question becomes different. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The risk. And if the one shouldn't eat anyway for therapeutic reason, when one goes to the doctor for when one wants to look after one's health. But if you want to eat healthy food, with omega-3 amino acids, then eat nuts and lots of vegetable and fruit. Contain lots of this stuff. It doesn't have to be fish.
Now, what about eating seafood ethically? If we know so much the crisis in the world, how do we choose or choose not to, to eat fish?
I don't believe that you can. You can get into that that swamp without sinking in it, because in the rich country in the northern hemisphere are net importers of seafood, and you cannot consume seafood, whatever it is, without thinking that it has to be exported. It is being exported by countries that usually are poor and whose population doesn't eat enough. And this is very strong when you consider, for example, fish that are taken off West Africa and consumed in Europe and North America, because the fish in the North Atlantic are not anymore, they are entirely depleted. And I don't think that you can ethically eat fish, but you cannot also ethically eat meat because you use so much water that you cause all kind of problems. You cannot also ethically drive a car. What I want to say is that when you get into behaving ethically as a consumer, you find yourself that the best way to not get into problem is not to eat at all. And I don't make much sense probably, but
I think that
we cannot eat. We cannot live in Canada, stuff our faces with fish or meat or whatever, and be ethically unconnected with the rest of the world because we have eaten, we have bought food at Capers. This is an illusion. What we can do is actually recognize the mess we're in, and as citizens, as concerned citizens, get involved in changing the situation which forces us to make unethical decisions all the time.
Can you tell us about some of the ecosystem modeling tools you have developed over the years, specifically
yes, right.
The fish-based ecopath.org,
yeah.
as well as the Sea Around Us project here at UBC?
Yeah. Ecopath is now handled by another colleague. It is has been developed by other colleagues mainly. But this is a software for quick and rapid construction of an ecosystem and its food web that essentially could not be done before, and now it can be done because this is very straightforward, and now hundreds and thousands of people use the software. With regard to FishBase, that is www.fishbase.org, you have a description of all the fish in the world and what they do or what they eat or how they grow and so on. And this database is so rich in information that even though it was initially conceived for scientists only, it is now used by everybody, anglers clubs and students in high schools and so for term papers and so on. It is very widely used. It has The last month, it had 34 million hits per month. This is absolutely huge. It has over 1 million visitors per month. And they find everything that they want to know about fish in dozens of languages and with different scripts and so on, Hindi and Chinese and Thai and so on. So this is international. And the name of fish are given in all possible languages. We have 200 languages, over 200 languages right now. And the Sea Around Us, finally, is a seaaroundus.org, in one word, seaaroundus.org, is a database that we make available through our website on the fisheries of the world that gives you an impression of the fisheries of the world in a fashion that is not as boring as poring over large tables of numbers, but gives you everything in graphical format so that you can get a quick impression. And it's very much used by schools and so on, for people to acquaint themselves with the fisheries of the world.
Now, you have said that one of the solutions to the world's fisheries crisis is the creation of protected marine areas, the equivalent of national parks on land. Can you talk about statistically, how many of these marine areas exist in the world, and of course, what you would like to envision to have in the future in terms of increasing the amount that exists in the world?
Marine protected areas are a way to protect animals of the sea in the same manner that we protect trees in a park from being logged, and you do underwater Stanley Park, so to say. And it turns out, though, that people's conception of the sea is such that they have problem imagining underwater parks, especially fishermen and so on. But they have problem imagining, and so they oppose parks. They oppose marine protected areas. And throughout the world, there is a very strong opposition. They want to fish everywhere, and they want to get after the last fish, which they will soon do if they are allowed to continue as they do now. And for that reason, we have only a very tiny amount of marine protected area. So in the world, in the terrestrial systems, we have about 10 to 15% of the land is reserved for forest and for parks, about in all countries, 10 to 15%. In the ocean is 0.7%, less than 1%. And various organizations, for example, the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is an international treaty organization which whose seat is in Montreal, has declared that we should have 10% of the world ocean protected by 2010. Now, we're going to have 1% at most. That gives you an idea of how much there is a gap between what we have to do in terms of not only aspiration, but in terms of technical measures to protect our fish and what we have achieved so far.
Can you give us some examples of some that exist in the world and what results have been achieved in terms of seeing species flourish or come back?
Yeah. The largest marine protected areas in the world, one of the largest, is the Great Barrier Reef of Australia. And Australia is the place where some of the best reefs in the world now can be seen, for the simple reason that they have been protected. In most other countries of the world, the coral reefs are destroyed and they contain no fish or tiny fish, and this is overall a loss. The pictures of destroyed reefs you will find in countries that allow them to be fished without a marine protected area. So the great Australia is really an example for a country that has identified the need to set up marine protected areas and patrol them and protect them. The U.S. is in the business of creating big ones, and in the northwestern Hawaiian Island is one case in point. There is an enormous marine protected area, as I mean, recently created by President Bush, of all people. And this will be a monument. This is called a monument for fish and other marine animals that will protect them. But in Canada, there are only a number of tiny marine protected area which cannot protect anything.
Yeah, there's about 5% of Canada's coastal waters are technically off limits, but two-thirds of the area enforcement is non-existent. Is that right?
Yeah.
So, Dr. Pauly, you are no longer director of the UBC Fisheries Centre.
Yep.
What is the next chapter in your life, and where are you going now with your research?
I'm going on sabbatical for 6 months in early next year. I'm going to Europe. I'm going to write finish one book and start another one. The next chapter in my life is obviously is writing quite a few things that I had deferred. I'm quite productive, but my ideas run ahead of my writing ability. So I will be writing things, and that's the next chapter in my life.
Can you give us a hint of what you might be writing or will be writing?
One of the book is called Five Easy Pieces. It's almost finished. It will comment on the impact and of five papers that I published earlier, which assessed the world, the impact of fisheries on the ocean, and that is almost finished. And another one will reconnect with my dissertation research about oxygen and the growth of fish.
Well, it's really a privilege to speak with you, and thank you so much. And I wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors.
Well, thank you very much.
Right, thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Listening to an interview with Dr. Daniel Polly, who has just taken a sabbatical leave from the UBC's Fisheries Center. Music on this show is from the album Stroll in the Cool from the UBC School of Music, performed by Professors Jesse Reed on bassoon and Michael Strutt on guitar. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM on the Point Grey campus in Vancouver. Stay tuned to the show next week as we conclude this two-part series about the current crisis of the world's marine ecosystems with an interview with Mr. Todd Jones, who will speak about his groundbreaking research of leatherback turtles that took place right here on UBC South Campus. Mr. Jones has worked with today's guest, Dr. Daniel Polly, in modeling leatherback turtle growth and energy requirements to determine how leatherbacks will be affected by the destruction of food webs due to overfishing of the world's oceans. Stay tuned now for the best in sports with Wiener's Barbecue. We would love to hear your comments and feedback of the show. Please email us at proftalk@gmail.com. or visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also hear the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.